RehabCast, the official podcast of ACRM and the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, is sponsored in part by Shepherd Center.
My name is Zach Bradley. I'm a current employee and former patient of Shepherd Center, which specializes in medical treatment, research, and rehabilitation for people with spinal cord injury, brain injury, stroke, multiple sclerosis, spine and chronic pain, and other neuromuscular conditions. Our specialized clinicians serve as complex care partners. They collaborate with medical professionals who refer their patients to Shepherd Center to help them achieve optimal outcomes, returning them to their homes, communities, schools, and workplaces.
The research is coming back to Chicago. Join us for ACRM 2022, our 99th annual conference. This meeting will be in person and online. Save the dates, October 6th through 11th. Call for proposals and registration coming soon. Go to acrm.org/2022.
You're tuned in to the 39th episode of RehabCast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox of the Shepherd Center in Atlanta. We're hearing about a new kit on the block for lymphedema management. The LymphaTouch Negative Pressure Massage Device is investigated by Dr. Jeanette Lee of the San Francisco State University. And then we're going to check in with Justin Chi, who's a grad student in Rehab Sciences and Biomedical Engineering at the University of Toronto. Justin's been sorting through all the MS gate parameters you can shake a stick at and sits down with us to tell us what's most important in predicting disability and falls. Joining us now on the RehabCast, we have Dr. Jeanette Lee. Dr. Lee is Associate Professor and Chair of the San Francisco State University Doctor of Physical Therapy Program. It's a joint program shared with the University of California, San Francisco. She and her colleagues have published on a treatment of breast cancer-related lymphedema with a negative pressure device, a pilot randomized control study. Dr. Lee, thank you for joining us today on the RehabCast.
Good morning, Dr. Vox. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I really appreciate your being here, and you have quite a lot of professional expertise in this particular condition. It's always interesting to see novel research questions, or at least the first randomized controlled trial of something that's relatively new. This device has not come across my radar before, but I gather from your industry, in particular of lymphedema management area of expertise, it's something you guys have been seeing out there for a while with kind of smaller, kind of company funded type trials and so forth. And you're looking at a particular type of negative pressure device, the LymphaTouch. I gather there may be some others along this line as well.
There is, and there's been some devices that are quite similar, but I believe like LymphaTouch is probably the more well-known of all of the devices out there. For the past few years now, quite a few clinicians have talked about their experiences anecdotally with the use of this device, primarily in breast cancer related lymphedema, but certainly in other swelling disorders, I guess is how we might categorize kind of like the big bucket of of edematous conditions.
Yes, and in fact, the kind of gold standard treatment that you're doing there, with regards to the complete decongestive therapy, is something we've certainly been doing in our stroke population, hemiplegia, related dependent extremity edema, both arms and legs, have found a good amount of efficacy there as well. Certainly, I wonder if this type of treatment may be something we'll be exploring in that indication as well. Now, it's somewhat counterintuitive, I suppose, given that the kind of current standard is to apply positive pressure, I suppose, to a swollen extremity. And this is negative pressure, which sounds on the surface like it might make it worse. Well, just describe the device to us and kind of what this looks like for our listeners.
I think that was actually you make a good comment about the positive pressure versus negative pressure, and positive pressure in terms of kind of the more traditional manual lymphatic drainage strokes, where the strokes are typically pretty light to the touch. And the thinking there is like, you don't want to exert too much pressure in so that you don't compress the lymphatic vessels. whereas this negative pressure device functions in the opposite way. There's a suction cup basically that attaches to the machine, and you can program the machine to exert a certain amount of pressure. And I believe, like for this particular model that we were using, it was anywhere from 80 to 250 millimeters of mercury. And so when you apply the suction cup to the skin, then it sort of has this like, I guess like, for lack of a better word, like it kind of like pulls the skin apart and sort of like encourages the lymphatic vessels to widen a little bit, I guess, in a way. And then that theoretically should encourage lymph flow. The other thing that it does is sort of like is able to move kind of like the fascia between your tissues, basically. And so that theoretically should also improve the lymph flow. So with this particular device, the suction cups come in like many different sizes. So the understanding that like you can use a smaller suction cup in the neck or kind of the smaller areas around the breast, and you can use like a larger suction cup with like the upper arm, for instance, or kind of like the side, the trunk, for instance.
Are there any particular contraindications for fragility of skin and wounds, I would imagine?
Yeah. I think sort of the general contraindications for the performing of manual lymphatic drainage, I believe, like would apply to the negative pressure device as well. There's the skin fragility. There's also whether, you know, like there's just some people who can't tolerate. Mm. You can definitely like toggle the pressure. But you know, like you might have some patients that are not able to tolerate even the least amount of pressure from the negative pressure device. Okay. There's also sort of the issue of skin sensitivity too. But that would be true for patients who do manual lymphatic drainage or negative pressure device.
I see.
In general too, just kind of within the MLD, within the lymphedema world, you know, like if you have like an active fever or like an infection, then these conditions would be contraindications for both.
Now, even the fact that these treatment sessions, this device applying negative pressure, roving over the entire extremity with a suction cup device, I gather, is it lubed up in some way so that you're rolling over?
No, everything? So you'll probably find some variation between lymphedema therapists. But in general, like the clinicians I work with, and definitely at least for this study too, we had three clinicians that did the treatment sessions, and all of us have lymphedema certifications. And I believe like all of us have at least 10 years of experience with this population. But we chose to not use a lubricating substance. So we just kind of like, you know, the skin was clean, but we didn't use like a moisturizer or like massage cream or anything like that.
Okay, so it's not something that's on constantly and that you're moving. You're putting it in each spot where the...
So you're kind of moving it in a way that like, once the suction cup is on, it's on the skin, right? You can like pull it up a little bit to kind of like increase, like pull it up a little bit without completely removing the suction cup. Does that make sense? And then you can sort of like move it along the skin in that way.
I'll move it along a little bit. Okay, very good. And after each of these sessions, it's still coupled with patients going back in their lymphedema garment to provide, again, some positive pressure.
Yeah.
So they open up the channels, and now hopefully things are going to be pushed out.
Yeah, like and part of the reason why we did that too was to sort of impose some measure of sameness between the two groups, so to speak. Yeah.
And so as per the title, this is a randomized trial comparing the kind of current standard of treatment, the manual lymphatic drainage, to this new technique. And in the course of that, besides the individual treatment, each person is going back into their dressing and so forth. Now, tell us about the general types of patients that you're talking about. These aren't folks who have recently developed lymphedema. It's somewhat more chronic, a year out, sometimes even over 5 years out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the average for the study was definitely more than a year out, although at least a year out was our kind of like baseline requirement, eligibility criteria.
So definitely no question about this spontaneously having gone away on its own.
There's also the question of, I think like one of the things we were interested in with this study was looking at the more chronic cases of lymphedema versus like acute, the more acute case of lymphedema. And that's the reason why we decided on a time frame of that more than 1 year out.
Comparing these folks, obviously there are the standard measurements of lymphedema that you're tracking. There's this DASH questionnaire mm-hmm. as well about function. I understand there wasn't too much change with regards to function or people's reports of the function of their extremities. Although in your population, they were fairly minimally impaired, right?
Yeah. One of the things too that we were kind of surmising is like when you have lymphedema for that prolonged period of time, like many people sort of find ways around it. Because it's kind of like when we work with patients that have had a chronic condition that may limit function, such as a stroke or, mm-hmm. you know, like back pain or anything like that. Like many of them will continue to function. They just find sure. a different way to do it. And because the DASH is a self-report questionnaire, your perception of how you're doing, you know, versus like what you objectively see might be different.
So while there's not a lot of change in that, there is certainly change in the objective measurements of lymphedema volume. Review for our audience briefly, like how do we accurately measure lymphedema volume?
So for this study, we measured arm circumference. And so we mm-hmm. measured at different points in the arm, both the affected arm and the unaffected arm. And then we derive a volume calculation using a formula that's for a truncated cone, basically, that's been published elsewhere. We also use something called the bioelectrical spectroscopy, or BIS. And that is a device that where you, basically what happens is you run a very, very low level of current through your body and you're measuring the resistance with or without, you know, an extra amount of fluid in your limbs, basically.
Mm.
And then uh-huh. with the BIS, the device that does the BIS, we use a device called an LDEX, which mm-hmm. is pretty widely used in lymphedema research, I would say. And that gives you kind of a ratio of the affected to the unaffected side. And that, at least on the device, it gets the measurement produced. It produces a number that's a number on a bell curve. So you can see like how different it is compared to quote unquote the regular population.
And ultimately we're comparing 12 sessions, an hour each over a month to a month and a half. You found a clear winner. How dramatically would you say negative pressure, I mean, in terms of meaningful volume change that you're seeing versus the decongestive therapy? What is this? How sizable is this difference?
I'll point out that both groups actually showed a decrease in volume.
I see. Okay.
Just that the volume decrease in the negative pressure group was a little bit more significant, was bigger than the one and more statistically significant than the one in the manual lymphatic drainage group. Just the amount of change between limbs in the negative pressure group was just far greater than the one in the MLD group.
So far greater to an extent that you were surprised by. Is it something that's clearly obvious to both clinician and patient alike that this is obviously this wasn't a crossover group. So it's not mm-hmm. like patients or clinicians could compare in the same person the treatment of one versus the other, but what I'm getting at is obviously there's statistically significant results which are important, and then there's like patently obvious results. Like on what scale is this?
I think your scale was like patently obvious, to sort of like obvious
to someone who has no experience with lymphedema. It's like, wow, that extremity is far less swollen than this other one, for example, which received standard treatment. You know, something like that.
I would say that there were pretty big changes. I think more importantly was from a patient standpoint, like all of the patients that were in the negative pressure group, like really liked it, liked it in the sense that like they felt it was very helpful for them. They felt like their function was better. They felt that their arm felt lighter, you know, however you sort of like mm-hmm. perceive that description. And from a clinician standpoint, I will say that like the ability to sort of be, the ability to objectively say like, this is the amount of pressure and this is what I'm seeing is good. Mm-hmm. Saves your hands a little bit, kind of in the vernacular, because like you're kind of operating the suction device rather than sort of like using your hands.
Right. Okay. So this is one particular device that you guys are exploring here, the LymphaTouch. And is it part of a larger competitive industry or of devices, or how would you describe how many options there are out there in terms of negative pressure?
Right now, I'm going to say like not a lot. I'm not super familiar with all of the players kind of in the negative pressure device market. And, but I would imagine that like, if there are sort of like wider applications to a negative pressure device, like the kind of the notion, there are negative pressure devices available in the wound care for wound care etiologies and for wound care interventions. And, you know, like then there's this question about like, is there an ability to sort of cross over those devices, for instance?
Okay.
So that's sort of, but like within the lymphedema, or within sort of the breast cancer related lymphedema market in particular, there's not a lot of negative pressure players.
Okay. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's this new thing, which I hope doesn't catch on, although okay, there's no rules against it. I guess it will. But in the medical device industry, I've started to notice these subscription models where the company gets a cut of every time a device is used on a particular patient. So literally built into the software of devices, you can only use it, 100 times or something. You got to recharge it, for example, or maybe even each use of it is linked to a particular patient account with the device company. Personally, I think healthcare providers need to all push back against this. This is going to raise expenses.
Agreed.
But is this device that way, by the way?
Well, so when we were running the study, the device was not like that. So okay. The study was funded by a grant through the American Physical Therapy Association. So we did not have those limitations, so to speak. And you know, philosophically, I agree with you 100%. I think like for many medical devices like this sort of out in the market, your extra cost comes because every so often you have to replace the suction cups, for instance. And for instance, like for folks who use the bioelectrical impedance devices, you have to replace the electrode pads like with every patient, or you know, the same patient uses the same pad. So, you know, like the company recoups its cost in some other way. What I've heard, and this is just sort of what I hear and within kind of like that industry, is like there are maybe like initiatives to try to make a home model for these devices, so like patients can kind of like rent them or like take them home, which is already a model that's being seen in some of the other devices that are being used to treat or manage manage lymphedema, such as those intermittent compression pump devices that a patient can sort of lease or to take home and then use at home. So my feeling is that the negative pressure devices are probably heading in that like similar direction, particularly if they can nail down maybe a protocol that says like, okay, for your arm, you know, this is kind of like what you do. Not to say like this is sort of my other maybe soapbox within the medical device world, is this whole notion of like one size fits all, where really it's one size fits none.
Yes. Yeah. It needs to be tailored and so forth. Yeah. Yeah. That's just a particularly frustrating trend, particularly when, in my world, I'm doing largely inpatient medicine and, you know, we're utilizing, you know, devices across various populations and so forth. Sometimes I feel like, I mean, it's not just the rehab industry, but, whether therapists and doctors and everyone, healthcare, oftentimes seems like we lack a particular wherewithal in order to, stay on top of these issues as they develop within industries like the device industry. Would struggle to imagine, you know, some dental chair company or something that's going to say, well, dentist, we're going to start charging you $50 for every patient that sits in this chair, and the dentist just rolling over and saying, oh, sure. You know, meanwhile, you know, everyone else in healthcare, deals with the bubbling up of these technologies with similar economic models, and it's just you know, rather unfortunate. So anyway, something I'm always interested in when we're talking about a new device is to what the model is.
I feel like this is like a like a much wider ranging conversation. Mm-hmm. The whole kind of like medical devices and just healthcare equity in general.
Well, thank you for this interview. I encourage folks to go look at the paper, this randomized trial, the first, looking at negative pressure treatment for lymphedema. Obviously, a huge patient population, even just confined to, you know, breast cancer, but there are many other etiologies for this sticky condition, and anything we can find to help is certainly worth exploring. It's always important to do so independently from, you know, economically interested companies and so forth, and good to see independent trials of such technologies. So thank you very much, Dr. Lee.
Thank you very much, Dr. Box.
Joining us now on the RehabCast, we have Justin Chi. Justin is a graduate student in the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences and Biomedical Engineering at the University of Toronto. He and colleagues there have published a review article on, specifically a meta-analytic review article on the influence of multiple sclerosis on spatiotemporal gait parameters. It's a systematic review and meta-regression. This obviously is a disability pattern that affects many hundreds of thousands of people around the globe and of great importance in rehabilitation generally. So you picked a big topic there, Justin. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about prior reviews of gait that have been done in MS, and why in the world do we need a new meta-analysis on it?
Well, we know from past research, really, there's been a rise in research on MS. So we saw the number of publications on gait in MS increasing steadily over time with an accelerated pace in the past 30 years, really. And an incremental rise in reporting on this topic was first observed in the 1970s, followed by a growth and accelerated pace from the 1980s into the present day. And from an historic perspective, this recent expansion in research was foreshadowed by clinical advancements such as MRI technology and disease-modifying drugs, the development of modern gait analysis systems such as 3D motion capture systems and instrumented walkways, and then the emergence of new applied technologies such as wireless technology. And what we found from the other review studies on this topic and the research that was done is that we know that there are significant differences between individuals with MS and non-MS control groups. Those differences are well documented in this literature. For example, individuals with MS have a slower preferred gait speed and increased gait asymmetry. But clearly, not all individuals with MS are clinically similar. Pathological mechanisms such as inflammation, demyelination, and axonal degeneration, they all have a variable effect on the central nervous system. And this variable effect disrupts cognitive, sensory, and motor functions that are fundamental to gait in many ways. So characterizing individuals with MS as a single group neglects this heterogeneity. We see this a lot in the previous literature on, especially the review literature, where the comparisons are focused on the individuals with MS to non-MS controls. But thankfully, newer research on MS and gait has been focusing on clinically different subgroups. Prominent examples are disability severity and fall classification, which we focus on in our review study. So the increase in reporting on these subgroups is a promising and encouraging trend in MS research that I hope continues.
What would you say the clinical gait analysis is being done routinely in the neurology MS clinics at this point? What's your understanding of what clinicians are doing as they are, you know, dosing drugs and getting follow-up imaging and so forth?
Well, a lot of the literature right now is focused on, and a lot of the work that's done in the clinics is really using the performance of gait. They look at gait performance by conducting clinical gait tests. Mm-hmm. These are really important, useful tools. They often use a stopwatch timer, or, you know, they typically measure gait without instrumentation. But the issue with that is that, you know, the way that they're measuring gait may not be sensitive enough to detect subtle differences in gait performance. So, you know, there are newer technologies available now. I mentioned a couple, you know, 3D motion capture, pressure set of walkways, and even more recently, inertial sensing systems. And you know, as technology develops and improves, these can make it possible to more easily assess gait in not just gait laboratories, but in clinical settings. So hopefully there's more of a shift towards technology-based gait assessment tools in clinics, and then that could, you know, improve the ability of clinicians to differentiate between the subtle differences of their patients.
Yeah, there's always this lag between, you know, the scientific literature and what we're learning and what meta-analyses like these can reinforce that we information that we could gather on individual patient populations, and then what's actually done in the real world for reasons of, you know, time management, efficiently dealing with large patient populations, and certainly what different insurers are willing to pay for in terms of analysis and so forth. It seems to me, my impression, I don't treat an MS population myself in rehabilitation. My impression is that when it comes to MS in particular, it's only a small subpopulation of MS patients who get access to rehabilitation resources generally, or certainly anything approaching gait analysis.
Right.
In terms of what you're demonstrating, though, in this meta-analysis, is that there's quite a lot of information there to be had that perhaps could be, you know, maybe predictive of the MS course, certainly detailing the type of disability, maybe even tracking along with, well, certainly different treatments that could impact it, and certainly could be useful as part of, you know, tracking clinical interventions. Of course, MS, unlike many other neurodegenerative conditions and neurological conditions that we see in rehabilitation, does have a plethora of treatment options. And so perhaps, therefore, could, you know, gait analysis could be kind of packaged into that.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the results of our work have significant implications for a number of things, including clinical decision making, the effectiveness of clinical interventions, and even community insight into community challenges. So like when regarding disability, we know that a large proportion of individuals with MS have ambulatory difficulties at all stages of their disease course. The gradual loss of independent gait function they experience can have dire consequences. For example, it can adversely affect employment rates, health resource utilization, social participation in the community, and quality of life. This is why walking is one of the most valued functions by this population. And regarding falls, we know that over half the individuals with MS experience falls in the prior 2 to 6 months, and 12 to 60% of those falls result in injury. Several factors that affect mobility are also associated with falls risk. These factors include fear of falling, assistive device use, balance deficits, and fatigue. So with this study, we have new knowledge about how gait characteristics differ between more precise patient cohorts. Clinicians can use these results to make more nuanced comparisons between their patients, and they have a better understanding of what to expect as the disease progresses and adjust treatment accordingly. The reference values can also be used by scientists to evaluate how effective new interventions are. For example, we know that a wide range of training programs can be used to elicit significant changes in spatiotemporal gait characteristics in individuals with MS. Pilates, for instance, can increase gait speed by 0.2 meters per second. Robot-assisted gait training can reduce double support time by 4.6%. And our findings suggest that the gait enhancements achieved by these interventions may be sufficient to affect disability or falls risk if their effects can be sustained. Our results also provide insight into the mobility challenges that individuals with MS experience in the community and how they compensate for those challenges. The differences we observed have serious implications for the ability of more severely affected individuals to adapt to environmental challenges, such as crossing timed signalized intersections, especially when tripping or slipping hazards are present. Some of the differences, like a reduction in gait speed, have even been associated with increased fatigue, decreased physical activity, lower balance confidence, and decreased health-related quality of life. At the same time, though, the results also indicate that these individuals may be adopting a more cautious and stable gait pattern. Using the same example of gait speed, walking with a reduced gait speed can lower one's falls risk and fear of falling. And that's because the reduced momentum gives them more time to compensate for the unexpected perturbations. That's why in our study, we emphasize that not all gait differences between the subgroups are detrimental, we really need to observe the results from a broader perspective that takes into account compensatory strategies, not just changes that are associated with poor clinical outcomes.
You looked at certain interventions that were done, like Pilates, balance training, and yoga therapy, and so forth. I was curious, obviously, this is a rehabilitation journal, and these are all rehabilitation interventions, but are there studies out there that you've come across where the pharmaceutical industry, looking at different biologics being developed for MS and so forth, are using gait analysis in terms of their outcomes?
Absolutely. And that's very common in pharmacological studies. You do see in the MS population there, you know, when a new drug is developed, they do test the effect on gait characteristics, particularly, you know, if that drug is, you know, related to mobility and supposed to help mobility in some way, you know. So that is a common gait research is common in pharmacological studies.
Yeah, well, I was wondering if in the pharmaceutical industry studies that are being done, if they're utilizing any norms in order to compare the patient populations, if indeed this is the development out of this meta-analysis, we're finding like, you know, what we might find to be an expected gait speed for someone at a particular EDSS or that type of thing, or if this is kind of a new development that both for the rehabilitation and literature as well as pharmacologic literature to start to have some norms to be able to compare outcomes by, whether they be rehabilitative or pharmacologic.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, obviously, you know, this is studied a lot, but a lot of the studies, I think, to date, just focus on the changes within those individuals rather than establishing norms. It's often very hard to record data on a lot of patients with MS, you know, the difficulties getting them into the lab, getting, you know, they can only tolerate so much time being assessed and things like that. And it's also difficult to conduct gait analyses in many circumstances, particularly clinical ones. So the pharmacologic research, you know, to date, it hasn't really established norms, to my knowledge. That's really where you get, that's really the value of pooling some of these studies together in a study design like a meta regression, so that you can increase the sample size and take a look at and really establish those norms, which is what we tried to do, not only for our study, but for all the studies.
Well, I'm curious about some of your lines of research in MS or gait. Do you have other areas that you're exploring? I often find when folks are doing meta-analyses in a particular topic that you're also might be a part of a research group that's planning a particular intervention as well, or indeed other lines of rehabilitative research that you do.
That's correct. So the reference values we've generated in this study have really paved the way for two additional studies that I'm including in my doctoral dissertation. So one of the studies that I'm investigating is assistive devices for MS. The use of assistive mobility devices is actually relatively unexplored in MS research. And this is so surprising because certain devices like rollators or four-wheeled walkers are so commonly used. And paradoxically, assistive device use has been identified as a fall risk factor in this population. And we don't know if individuals are falling because of intrinsic factors like their fatigue or problems with the devices, or maybe they're causing them to trip, or challenges in the environment, but more likely it's a combination of all those factors. So in the study I'm working on right now, I'm focusing on describing and comparing rollator-assisted gait across different levels of disability among individuals with MS. And the upper limbs are used heavily during rollator-assisted gait, and this has implications for trunk motion. So the work that I'm seeking to perform is to really bring about a deeper understanding of the relationship between assistive device use, trunk motion, and spatiotemporal gait parameters so that we can more effectively address the high falls risk in this population. And then in the final study of my thesis, I'm going to be exploring the impact of fatigue on rollator-assisted gait and trunk motion. In the long run, though, I hope to explore how biofeedback can be used to enhance the gait performance of individuals with MS. Assistive devices seem to be a perfect platform to administer training interventions. And with rapidly evolving changes in technology, there are some exciting opportunities ahead to create new and effective gait interventions. Exploring these options can lead to advances that will prolong the independence of individuals with MS and improve their quality of life. And I find those prospects quite exciting.
Definitely. You know, rollators are something that I have certainly not perhaps kept, quote unquote, up to date on. And when I think about it now, talking with you, what an amazing platform walkers are, I suppose, to integrating quite a lot of computer technology and potential for feedback, you know, via the, you know, tactile feedback and so forth. You could be basically, you know, rolling along with more of a biofeedback device that was kind of giving you almost almost just like your smart car is warning you that you're kind of veering out of the lane or giving you a little bit of bump or tactile feedback. Your rollator could be doing the same thing. Does what I'm talking about already exist or in development, or could you educate me there?
Well, I think, you know, when I started this work many years ago now, I think that technology was a point where a lot of these, you know, things were just like, you know, hopes for the future. They weren't quite, you know, able to be realized. And certainly for an individual like me, I'm not a clinician. I'm not an engineer by training. It's sort of daunting thinking about, you know, developing the technological side. But as you mentioned, a lot of these things, you know, with the smartphone, smart devices, and commercially available like inertial sensors that are, you know, incorporated into what we're wearing. And, you know, there's so much potential with the new technology that I think that a lot of the things you just talked about are really, we're on the cusp of being able to actually look at these things and look at ambulation in everyday life and start to quantitatively measure, you know, some of those challenges that these people are experiencing. And on top of that, look at, you know, biofeedback and other training mechanisms that could, in the moment, intervene and prevent falls. And, you know, really, after we've identified where they're falling in the community more in more detail, and, you know, how their trunk motion is affected, how their upper body is affected, then we can look at, you know, applying stimuli such as, you know, tactile feedback, or, you know, a sound, an auditory tone, or even some sort of visual cue that will help keep these individuals, help them target that in target to make their gait safer. So there's so many tools available, even by putting, say, an iPad on a rollator itself. You know, there's an opportunity for, you know, auditory feedback, there's vibratory feedback, there's visual cues that could be displayed on the iPad. And that's a commercially available product that anybody can have access to if they download an app, for instance, that helps to do these things. So I think there are a lot of exciting possibilities right now.
Fascinating. All right. Well, Justin Chi from the University of Toronto, graduate student there, will be defending his PhD, I gather, later this year. Congratulations on this publication of an important meta-analysis on spatiotemporal gait parameters and MS. I'm sure will be well-referenced in this large literature going forward. And thank you for your time here today on the RehabCast.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And that'll do it for this 39th episode of the RehabCast. Please like on your podcast app and take a moment to send this show to a friend and colleague. Until next time.